Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross with you, and once again, a whole week's worth of stuff to talk about in the space of just a few days. And Rob, how's everything going in New York?
It's going all right, John. You know, it was a fast week, which I'm very, very grateful for. You know, it almost felt like a holiday week again. But no, it just zipped right by. But God knows, from the moment that we did our last show, there's been absolutely no lack of interesting and what was that kind of topics for us to talk about.
Right, right. Yeah, one of them actually comes out of the corporate world, and you just alerted me to this moments before we did our thing today, is the fact that there has been yet another major acquisition. And this one's kind of a head-scratcher.
Yeah, it only broke maybe 2 hours ago that CVS, the pharmaceutical chain, is buying out Aetna Health Insurance.
Imagine for that.
A mega billion-dollar deal. CVS, who is about to acquire the balance of, I believe it's CVS, who's about to acquire the balance of Rite Aid stores, unless it's the Walgreens chain. But in any event, CVS has Pac-Man their way through the various smaller chains that used to exist as far as the pharmaceutical world, or I should say pharmacy world, taking over such things as Eckerd and so on and so forth over the years, Revco, etc. Now they're taking over an insurance company. The argument that's being made to, I don't know if you want to call it, justify it or explain it so that people aren't in a state of panic, is it will help lower the cost of insurance by being able to incorporate local clinics rather than having to go to an emergency room if not necessary.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't see it that way at all. In fact, I think this is yet another in a long series of events that we've seen over the course of this year where it's the new monopoly because there's really no laws against it. All of the monopoly laws that we have, dating back to the Sherman Antitrust Act, have to do with owning the entirety of a particular sector of the economy. But that's not what they're doing anymore. So the new monopoly idea is not just to be the only oil company in the world. It's to own the entire supply chain from beginning to end. So where you have CVS buying up Aetna Health Insurance, well, then they've got you on the health insurance end. They've got you on the clinic end because of the partnerships that they already have through CVS. And they sell you the drugs that they prescribe via the health insurance at the clinics. They have you from beginning, from the first time you feel sick all the way up until you walk out of there with a prescription.
Correct. I mean, it goes back to the 90s, the mid-90s, when major record labels started to be Pac-Man'd by each other.
Right.
You know, there was, and of course, this goes with media companies that followed suit and so on, but I very clearly remember the days when I was at Atlantic Records and word came down that Universal Music was going to take over PolyGram, which, of course, they gutted. Not long after that, Sony or Columbia Records took over RCA/BMG. Then all of a sudden, within the last 3 years, we had, and there was a point where it was announced that Warner Music Group, who I worked for by working for Atlantic, was taking over EMI. Somehow, the European Union disallowed that one, which I've yet to figure out to this day why that was stopped. But it was okay 3 years ago when Universal quietly slipped in and took over EMI, gutting it, but handing the leftovers, which were fairly substantial, to Warner Music Group. Universal got the biggest part of the catalogs. They got the Beatles. They got the Beach Boys. I believe they got Frank Sinatra. Warner got everything else. Pink Floyd, the Hollies, the current catalog, the Parlophone label.
Right.
Everything, etc. And that started, you know, in the mid-90s. And then all of a sudden you had companies like Disney buying out ABC, Viacom buying out CBS. A couple of years ago it was – well, first it was Universal's other arm, Seagram's, or they were the parent company who bought out NBC. And then NBC Universal was taken over by Comcast. It's never-ending. Every time you turn around and there's some sort of competition out there, there is a – conglomerate ready to buy you out and make you part of the fold.
You're right. Well, CBS just went through that again with the radio division not long ago because the idea was originally that CBS told all the employees, well, we're just going to spin off CBS Radio into its own corporation. It's going to be its own entity unto itself. We're not selling it to anybody. There's going to be no acquisition. It'll just be its own thing. And as you might expect, that lasted for about 3 months before Entercom came in and purchased them. So now there is no CBS radio effectively anymore. It's all under the Entercom umbrella. But this is a little bit different. It would be more like in the example that you talked about, where the record companies were all buying up other record companies. Instead of that, it would be like a record company buying Gibson and then forcing all of their artists to use Gibson guitars and then buying Ludwig and making them all use Ludwig drums so that they have the entire supply chain from beginning to end. And that, I think, is something that nobody's even talked about dealing with, but it happened again this year when Amazon bought Whole Foods. So now all of the distribution and the grocery chain is already in place. So they're not buying up somebody that they're competing with. They're buying the next level down of their business.
Yeah, the funny thing that you mentioned about Gibson is that at one time Gibson and Fender, they were, because of course they're the two leading marketers, they were buying up the smaller companies. Fender owned, I believe, Guild and Gretsch at one point.
Gibson still owns Epiphone, sure.
Right. So, you know, beyond that, all you have left is what? Ibanez?
Right.
As a standalone company, quote unquote. And that's the thing. There's really no market competition. And it's interesting, and it's also equally tragic. You know, I didn't even know that CBS Radio no longer existed. But, you know, at the same time, earlier this week, there was another, although albeit quiet, major takeover, another corporation. And ironically enough, just as you were talking about it, I was thinking about it, and now I've forgotten who it was. But it's another one of those, wait a minute, did anybody stop and take notice of this? But I think my point is that, you know, we just had the Time Warner, oh, I now remember what it was. It's Time Incorporated, which had been spun off from Time Warner.
Right.
It was taken over this week by a company owned, of course, by the Koch brothers.
Imagine
which is really
that.
All now, yeah, I mean, that's just fantastic. But I was just thinking about how Time Warner had to spin off a whole bunch of its companies. They spun off, you know, Time Warner Cable, which was taken over by Charter, a.k.a. Spectrum, which is probably just as awful as Time Warner themselves had been. They had to sell off their sports franchises. There were three of them at one time. Now there's only two, which are in the localized area, because they had to sell them out of the Atlanta network when it was Time Warner Turner. So they had to sell off the Braves, they had to sell off the Hawks, and the Atlanta Thrashers NHL team, who wound up being quickly moved to Winnipeg.
Right.
And some of the second Winnipeg Jets. No matter how you slice it, whatever so-called anti-monopoly laws are out there are basically scofflaws at this point. They're on the books, but serve no purpose anymore.
Right, and there's under this administration and with this Congress, there's not going to be any enforcement anyway, so it doesn't make any difference, even if the violations happen. Nobody's out there policing the thing. Now, on top of all of that, there was something else that, going all the way back, since we're in the news industry anyway, with Time Warner owning CNN or wanting to buy CNN, that acquisition again, involving CNN is something that the Trump administration is trying to stand in the way of. But there were some things that went on in the news industry, going all the way back to the day after Thanksgiving. And we were going to talk about this at the time, and it kind of slipped by us. But Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski and everybody on MSNBC in the morning, not only did they phone it in, they pre-taped their entire broadcast for the day after Thanksgiving on a news network. Now, they, to their credit, they did not run the little live bug, which would have been a total violation, but they just never said that the thing was on tape. And they don't really have to, but still, on a news broadcast, when things happen and you don't say anything about them, it's kind of an obvious giveaway.
And the thing is that even though suddenly, of course, MSNBC is looked upon as this doyen of the left, it just goes to show you again, you can't trust literally any outlet of the media.
Right.
Certainly not on the right, but you know what? The left is just as farce driven. I mean, deception is deception. I don't care what, you know, what political stripes you wear. This is about as unprofessional as you can get. But then again, if you watch Morning Joe on a regular basis, and I've said so many times, my choices are so limited in the brief amount of time that I can watch some form of news in the mornings, that show has become such an just an unabashed dog and pony show.
Right.
It's just posturing by Joe Scarborough, who is so fair weather about his approach towards the current political climate, and Mika Brzezinski alternately mugging for the camera, you know, her expressions of exasperation, and then her sidebar commentary with that smug, all-knowing condescension. I'll tell you something, if we were all smart, we should just not bother watching any elements to morning TV. And speaking of morning TV, I think that kind of neatly segues into the next topic, because like I said at the start of the show, there's no shortage of things for us to talk about, and nothing was more surprising than that. On the ferry, as it were, when I was on my way to work, the breaking news alert from the New York Times, the staunch New York Times, that Matt Lauer had been fired by NBC News for inappropriate sexual behaviors. Well. First of all, I can't stand Matt Lauer. I think he's possibly one of the most vapid and appalling of all hosts, quote-unquote,
yeah,
interviewers I've ever seen, going back to his little shenanigans with Tom Cruise. And, of course, his little display during his, quote, interview with Hillary Clinton. You know, is this shocking? By no means. What I find so egregious about this one is you had people like Katie Couric, who I don't care what anybody says. Katie Couric is a very powerful, very high-profile news person, okay? And she's now coming forward saying, oh, yeah, he pinched my ass for years. You are the probably number one star of any news star at the time that you were at the height of your powers.
Yeah.
And you couldn't slash didn't say something about Matt Lauer then. I've got a very serious problem with all of this. But that's going to lead us to other sides to this story.
Well, right. And just to stick with the Matt Lauer thing for a minute, I mean, the things that he's been accused of, for him, again, to come out with this sort of half-apology, that letter that he put in on the first day after he had been fired, where he said, well, not everything is true, but enough of it's true that I'm really embarrassed. Shut up. Just don't even bother doing that. Because it's a non-denial denial, where in this case, a non-acceptance acceptance, where he says, well, I'm accepting responsibility, but by the way, it's not all true, without ever listing out what he has a problem with, which leaves you to wonder, okay, how much of the allegations and how much of the accusations are accurate?
Well, I think, you know, you and
it's
I...
It's wiggle room.
This is true. But the thing is, like, you and I both know this. You have a button that locks the door and, you know, women can't get out it.
Yeah.
I, of course, had that that secret tater cellar and, you know, a radiator and a chain and a bottle of chloroform handy.
Right.
But, you know, it's part and parcel of, you know, who we are and what we do, you know?
Yeah. At what point of creepy behavior do you have to realize that you're a creep, you know? And I'm embarrassed and I'm ashamed. No, you're not. No, you're not. Because if you were embarrassed and ashamed, you wouldn't have done it.
And you've been doing it for how many years? So
right.
Let's put it this way. The puff chest bravado always took precedence over, gee, you know, maybe I'll get caught for doing this. You know, but there you go. It's predictable. And that's what I don't like about it. Now it's becoming predictable. So now we're already, as we've talked about, in that state of, dare I say, near if not outright acceptance,
yep,
or jadedness towards this.
Right.
Like, oh, who's next? Well, there's plenty of next.
Yeah, there are plenty of next in every industry. And now, I mean, we're starting to see the record industry, not surprisingly, involved in this. And I'm still waiting for it to get to the corporate boardrooms. It will eventually. But the thing is, now we have to have a discussion about exactly what you were leading into, which is, okay, what counts? Because to see somebody like Matt Lauer engaged in behavior that's obviously boorish and idiotic and nasty, okay, fine. He loses his job, but he's got millions of dollars to fall back on. He's going to be fine. He'll buy an island somewhere. Then you have somebody like Garrison Keillor. And even when the word comes out about what he is supposed to have done, everybody kind of shrugs and says, really? That got him fired? And then, you know, you have the guy who started Def Jam Records, who also is being accused. And on that side, what he's being accused of doing is so much worse than what Matt Lauer is accused of doing. So there's a continuum here. There's a spectrum. And we have to decide, okay, what behavior is acceptable, even though it may be, you know, a little off color, versus the kind of things that, comparing the whole thing, if you have Garrison Keillor in the same line with Matt Lauer, there has to be some deference given to the fact that there are things you can do to somebody that are worse than other things you can do to them.
It's almost like looking at three sizes of coffee cups.
You know? Right. They're all coffee cups, but...
small, medium, and large. Matt Lauer is one from Garrison Keillor. I found that a real curiosity because of the comment that he made. It was almost ham-handed and sarcastically... when you read it, this is how it comes off. Sarcastically dropped when he said something along the lines of, if I had $100... No, if I had a dollar for every woman's back that I touched, I'd have $100. Now, was this meant as a putting your arm around somebody in a friendly fashion kind of way? Or was it, you know, putting your hand on a woman's bare back with the intention of exploring other regions?
Right.
That's number one. And by the way, also it came out along the lines that he seems to be something of a virulent anti-Semite due to a little piece that he had written about Christmas songs happen to be written by Jewish guys.
Right, right.
And his quote was, if you're not a member of the club, buzz off. Oh, okay, interesting, uber white man.
Mm-hmm.
Let's revisit this. So, you know, could he be, in fact, guilty of the second half of what I was talking about with him placing his hand on a woman's back? Well, apparently there have been buzz about him, too. I love how there's always buzz.
Right.
But that's conjecture and that's speculation. We don't need to go down that path. Let the professionals or the ones who think they're professionals sort that all out. But the Russell Simmons thing is a lot worse because you and I read the same thing. You were the one who alerted me to this story. And reading Jenny Lumet's statement, that translated to one thing and one thing only to me. And that wasn't sexual inappropriateness or sexual harassment. That was rape.
Yep.
Pure and simple. He forced me to have sex with him is rape. I can't interpret it any other way.
Right, exactly. And so that's what I mean about, you know, having him appearing in these news articles where they have three guys in a split, and one of them's Garrison Keillor, and one of them's Matt Lauer, and one of them's Russell Simmons. It's like, hang on a second here. Whoa. You know, there's got to be, we have to be able to discern a difference and assign an importance to that difference.
And today, of course, there's the news, not surprising. It's another one of those, and when was this finally going to come out? James Levine, the highly, quote, respected and almost near legendary musical conductor, orchestra conductor, is being accused of having basically molested this boy from the time that he was 15 onwards. You know, and that was back in the 80s, and that is nothing new because that's another one of those open secrets.
Uh-huh.
So this goes back to what we've been talking about previously, the open secret syndrome, especially with the what do they call them again? The Lavender Mafia?
Yes, right. Right, yeah, because, again, this is the thing that, what's his name, Corey Feldman had been talking about for years and years, banging the gong on, and nobody wanted to listen because it was weirdo Corey Feldman.
And, of course, Kevin Spacey, who could do no wrong.
Right, you know. Right.
Well, this is what it's come down to, folks.
Yeah.
This is part of everyday life and the news cycle of 2017, which is par for the course. And then, of course, we have our president what's gone on this week. Now, I don't think either one of us can sit down and accurately speak about the whole attempt at passing the new tax laws. But here's one thing that nobody seems to be realizing. I understand people are getting up in arms and they're screaming and, you know, waving the flags and holy hell is breaking loose and everyone's in a panic / fuck you Trump, fuck you Republican state of mind, but it still has to get through the House.
Right.
So
there has to be
take a breather. Don't, you know, it's like We're not, it's like you've said a million times already, we're not going to war with North Korea. Stop.
Yeah, okay. Right. And this thing has got to go through conference committee and be reconciled. And if they can't do that, the thing dies. And so whatever the final version is, all the notes and shit that they put in at the last minute becomes immaterial because none of that stuff is in the House bill. So until they can reconcile one with the other and there's a bill that they can send to Donald Trump, none of it makes any difference.
Right. So people just need to step back and wait.
Exactly.
Patience is your best bet against higher blood pressure.
Right. Now, in the middle of all of this, as you mentioned with the conductor being accused of molesting a young boy, we still have Roy Moore. Now, the latest on this, as we speak right now, is that the last poll that came out was the CBS News poll that had Doug Jones up by... Yeah, Matt, by the way, that's Roy Moore's opponent, Doug Jones, the Democrat, up by 3 percentage points.
And because I couldn't remember his name last week because he's become such a minor character involved in all of this. It's really embarrassing.
Here's the hilarious thing about that is even in the news headlines about this story, they always said the same thing. Roy Moore leads opponent or Roy Moore trails opponent. They don't use his name in the headlines either because they don't know who the guy is. So, yeah, he's so completely not a part of this story. It's, is Roy Moore going to be elected or not? And even with the poll showing him up by 3 points, that was right after another poll from a not terribly conservative agency came out and had Roy Moore up by 6. So at this point, don't go by any of the polling. The polling is meaningless, and I will stick to my original prediction that Alabama is going to send that fucking pedophile to the United States Senate. And this is the party, it's been said so many times before, the party of family values, the party of... Remember during the Clinton thing when their mantra was character matters? Character matters. No, it doesn't. It doesn't.
Yeah, well, look at the characters who have led that party since the Clinton era.
Right.
Let's start with Newt Gingrich.
Right. The guy who left his wife who was dying of cancer to marry a younger woman.
The guy who sent family postcards from Auschwitz. You know, come on.
Right.
Jesus fucking Christ. The thing is that also though you can't trust a poll for anything because we all know how polls turn out.
Yep.
Hillary Clinton with an 86% chance of winning the election. Well, what did that turn out to be? Nothing.
Yeah.
A big red herring. But aside from the fact that I completely agree, Roy Moore is going to win. Alabama should be shamed. This is one of those rare moments where I don't think I'm virtue signaling here, but I think Alabamians, whatever they're called, should be shamed for what they're about to do because it just – they're once again forcing themselves and a portion of the country into a very unfair viewpoint that most people tend to have about Southerners in general.
Right.
And I resent it, but they're doing it.
Right.
And they're doing it loudly. And to me, they should be shamed for doing so.
And they're not the only ones who should be shamed because, again, we have the leader of the United States Senate, Mitch McConnell, coming out. And first, when it looked like Roy Moore's poll numbers were tanking and he lost 10 points overnight and all of this, that he was going to get slaughtered in this thing. And Gingrich came out, or not Gingrich, but McConnell came out at that point and said, well, I think he ought to resign from the race and, you know, he ought to just go away because even if he gets into the Senate, we'll probably find reason to kick his ass back out. Paraphrasing. Now, as of today, McConnell says, well, I think we ought to let the voters decide. Really? And when did you come to that conclusion? Was it maybe when Roy Moore closed the gap and possibly took the lead again?
Well, you know, in talking about all of this, all of these little scandals and Southerners and, you know, we'll get to our beloved president in a moment, but I want to bring on a friend of ours with his opinion, because having once been the president of the United States, even though he's dead now, I think he has a couple of things to say on, you know, all of this.
Well, it's time for another episode of One Dick's Eye View. First, I want to just say, sock it to me. That's number one. I'm the grooviest president you've ever had. Remember, I'm the president that gave you the EPA, and I brought you pandas from China.
and we're eternally grateful.
But I want to talk about all this PC crap. It's not my fault. I didn't do it, you know, just because we had Roy Butts in there.
There's a name from the past. Oh, man.
I, tell you, I love Roy Butts. It's just fucking hysterical. And if you don't know, it also inspired an album title.
Did it really?
Yes, it did. For those who don't know, Roy Butts was...
Earl Butts.
Oh, thank you. You'll have to...
Roy Moore, Earl Butts, whatever.
He has to do with assholes. Earl Butts was a member of
my cabinet.
And I don't know if it was done intentionally or if it was supposed to be an off-the-cuff remark that he was making in just conversation, but
in conversation with John Dean and Pat Boone, by the way,
which equals the tapes are rolling.
Yeah, well, right.
John always had a tape recorder handy, just in case we needed to have a cover up. What cover up? Nothing. Scissors.
And in the conversation, Earl Butts made the now notorious comment about how the only three things that a black man wants or needs is a warm place to shit, tight shoes, and loose pussy.
Other way around. Yeah, tight pussy, loose shoes, and a warm place to take a shit.
And that was the first time somebody was actually dragged out and forced to resign. He had to resign that. And you go back in history, and there wasn't even so much of the furor over it as some of the most innocuous statements you and I have heard over the last couple of weeks.
Right.
You know, the things that are going on right now are far more egregious. And by the way, the album that we were referring to is an album that Alex Chilton had released called Tight Shoes and Loose Pussy.
Okay, right.
So, not a great album, but, you know, hey, it's worth the price of admission alone, just if you can find a copy, because it was only released under that title in Europe. It was known as Set over here.
Yeah, that's like that famous Rolling Stones album, Schoolboy Blues. Yeah, that's what it was called.
Is that Cocksucker Blues?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, that's really where the whole, you know, the first warning shot, if you will, for the movement that is known as PC really started to go off. And, you know, you still have the PC bullshit going on and the virtue signaling. And now comes time to ask a question, and it's a serious question. There was this... And I hadn't heard anything about it in all truth until the verdict was handed down this week, where a 5 times deported, illegal from Mexico, shot and killed a white woman in San Francisco while she was walking on the pier.
Yeah, Fisherman's Wharf, right?
Explain to me, first and foremost, 5 times deported, and he was still here. Second, he had a handgun. Third, he shot and killed this woman. For what reason, I don't know. And fourth, he's acquitted for it. Under the auspices of it was accidental.
Right.
Okay. Is anyone out there, and I'm calling out every single one of these fucking groups, and you know who exactly who I mean, and if I have to say it, I will. Is there anybody out there who's going to be protesting in her name, in her defense, over her murder?
Yeah, justice denied, right?
You know, the whole hashtag innocent women's lives matter. Anybody been doing that?
No, not that I've heard. Yeah, and it's funny because even on the right, where you would expect some outrage over this one, because this is Donald Trump made that particular case a campaign issue and said, you know, there's a reason why I say they're all murderers and rapists. Look at this guy, this illegal who shot this woman. And at the time, we all figured, well, yeah, but that guy's going to go to prison for this. Not so much. And they're quiet on this.
He's the only one who made a comment about it, naturally via tweet, but he is the one who tweeted that this was unacceptable and a disgraceful verdict. The question is, what the fuck are you going to do?
Right.
Or is this going to be yet another double standard because, well, she was a white woman, and because he's just some poor Mexican illegal immigrant.
Yeah, right. Well, and what'll happen is he'll end up being deported again, which means he'll be out of the country for at least the next 15 or 20 minutes. So, you know, where we go from there, who knows. But the one saving grace, I guess, in a case like this is he's going to do something else to get himself busted, and he will go to prison. I just hope it doesn't cost anybody else their life before he gets there. He's probably going to get busted for drugs. So who knows? But we'll find out.
I want to know about the gun. I really do want to know about the whole gun thing, because that it wasn't like it was a licensed weapon.
Right.
You didn't have a license to carry or own it.
No.
I mean, surely you can get caught on a technicality for that and be convicted, you know, come on.
Right. Yeah, at the very least, you would hope for something like that. But again, they're so stupid easy to get. Why they couldn't get a conviction on that case, I have no idea. They probably didn't even bother to charge because they figured they had the guy in murder. Maybe they'll retry him for that. But at the same time, I mean, the tweets that have come out of the White House, that was the only one this week that made any sense. And the latest round of this has been about a tweet that came out on Friday, and I remember at the time thinking, he just admitted to obstruction of justice. Now, keep in mind, obstruction of justice is what Richard Nixon was going to be impeached for.
No, he resigned. Hang on. I'm going to interrupt you there, because I obstructed nothing. Everything I did was for the good of the country.
Right.
I brought the troops home from Vietnam. Look, just because they happened to put a Band-Aid on the door at the Watergate Hotel doesn't mean that they were bad hombres. Build that wall.
We have to build a wall around Cuba. Well, and the thing is, you know, even in light of all of that, that's what he would have been impeached for had he not resigned in disgrace first. But that was the thing. I mean, at least at that point, there was disgrace. Now we have a guy who tweeted that he, in fact, knew Mike Kelly had lied to the FBI and Flynn. Mike Flynn. Yeah, Mike Kelly's an astronaut. Mike Flynn had lied to the FBI. He knew it and still urged James Comey to drop the investigation. That is the definition of obstruction of justice, and he admitted to it. So now the line is, well, he didn't really author that tweet. It was authored by his lawyer, because that's what you really want to do, is throw your lawyer under the bus in a case like this.
Right, to which the lawyer then can easily be put on the stand for obstruction of justice himself.
Right.
Perjury, disbarment.
Yep.
You know, all the good things that come along with this kind of shenanigans. The thing is, everybody is making a hue and cry, this time on the, oh, goody, goody, look, Flynn flipped on Trump. Now he's going to talk. He was charged with one count of lying to the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
A pardonable, by the way, by the president count. It's no different than me being pardoned by Jerry Ford.
Right.
It's a pardonable count if Trump was to do that. However, again, people get so far ahead of themselves, and I understand it, because they want Trump out of office. There's no question about it. But the thing is, like everything else, you're getting way ahead of yourselves. You know, surely they're going to find a way to finagle something where this too just disappears in a cloud of smoke, like everything else has done so far. Everybody was so excited that Manafort had been arrested and Papadopoulos had, you know, sung like a canary since May. And...
Right. But that's the thing, is that's where it gets back to not getting ahead of ourselves and having a little bit of patience and letting things unfold. Since the beginning, not Mueller himself, but everybody that's been truly analyzing that investigation has said the same thing. This is going to take a while, and it's going to take a while on purpose. He wants every indelible block put in place before he goes after somebody big. Now, the only interesting part about this is, does the investigation, as it was predicted on Thursday and Friday when the Flynn stuff was all coming out, turned directly toward Jared Kushner rather than Donald Trump? And if so, what does that mean to insulating the Trump administration? I mean, go back to the fact that it was Steve Bannon who was instrumental in getting Trump elected in the first place. It wouldn't be completely beyond the realm of comprehension to see Steve Bannon set a system in place where the last guy to fall to insulate Donald Trump would be the only Jew in the room.
Naturally. But look, apart from the fact that it's always, you know, pick on the Jew, And it's not my Zionistic paranoia coming to life.
No, it's Steve Bannon, for crying out loud. The guy is he an anti-Semite?
And let's call a spade here. Jared Kushner doesn't come from exactly the best line of people. His right. father's a convicted felon.
Yep.
His father did time. His father is a criminal. You know, so does the apple fall far from the tree? No. Does the apple fall far from the father-in-law of the tree? No. So would anyone be surprised? It would be, I think, much more to Mueller's case overall if he literally picked off everyone that was involved in the insular campaign angle and scope of Trump, whether it's Manafort, whether it's Flynn, whether it's Kushner. Look, he may go after Bannon at a point. Maybe.
I hope so.
I hope, you know what I hope? I hope it's some Mexican illegal with an illegal handgun who takes out Bannon.
Yeah, right.
Because he's somebody he's somebody who just really needs to go the right way.
Yeah, I would love to see that scabby frog do time, though.
Yeah, but you know what? I don't want to pay for him to have a cushy lifestyle in prison.
Good point.
You know, perpetrating his propaganda, you know? So, and plus while you're at it, take care of old Tippy the Turtle out there, too, McConnell. Because God knows, he's just such a duplicitous piece of shit that yep. he needs to go also. But, you know, anybody and everybody who is involved directly with the machinations of the Trump campaign, take them all out one by one and give them deals they have no choice that they can't refuse. Because you're going down, but you won't go down as badly if you help us.
Right. Yeah, do a John Dean on them. So, and there's nothing wrong with that. I see no problem with that. Even with somebody as scuzzy as Flynn, if it gets us to the place where the kind of change that needs to happen at the top eventually happens, I can sit back and wait for that. I have no problem there. And seeing a couple of these guys get a real pass or even a walk on a couple of these things doesn't bother me either. The problem is, as again, goes back to getting ahead of ourselves. If Donald Trump walks, who's president again?
Mike Pence.
Yeah.
Sure.
How is that a good idea?
It's not, and I'm sure his vice president would become Paul Ryan.
Right, exactly. And that line of succession, even if it gets to Pence at that point, then it leaves Paul Ryan in the next chair.
And God knows, I'm not big on... well, actually, I am. I'm a fan of presidential assassinations. You know, I wouldn't mind seeing somebody take out Kim Jong-un.
Right.
Why that hasn't been done yet, I don't know. So I wouldn't exactly weep if somebody decided to take out Pence or Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell. I'm not advocating violence. I'm just saying I'm a fan of that kind of thinking. I mean, it's what got us where we needed to be a long time ago, people. Okay.
Yeah, and that's it. I'm glad you brought up Kim Jong-un because it was something else that kind of trickled out because there's so much other shit distracting us from real news that when real news happens, it often goes underreported or completely missed. And that was the case with the Russian, or not the, well, it was Russian, that's the point, the North Korean missile that they shot off, and they said, oh, it's got an 8,000-mile range and it could hit anywhere in the United States. And then somebody showed the pictures of this thing taken off. And it's an old, probably about a 35 or 40-year-old Russian-made missile. Now, somebody needs to come up with how exactly it was that Kim Jong-un got his filthy little mitts on a Russian missile from the 1980s. Because if that thing came from Russia directly, you know, if they made some kind of backroom deals and have been supplying the North Koreans with armaments to the point of giving them an intercontinental ballistic missile, then who is it again that's supposed to hold them to account? Oh, right. It's us, except we have to depend on Donald Trump's State Department to do it.
Two words, P-tape.
Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, the whole thing is just going to go up in smoke. And, you know, and Donald Trump is still in that mode of every time it looks like something is going to stick, he does some other crazy shit and everybody starts, you know, following him over there. Oh, look, he's doing crazy shit again. And then we forget why it was that he was supposed to have gone down the last time.
You know, I had this conversation earlier today with my wife about how Donald Trump seems to escape, you know, any and he's almost Teflon coated, dare I say. Yeah. And she was saying, and it wasn't in defense of Hillary Clinton or that Hillary had gotten shafted, but she was making the argument, well, you know, the press really wanted Hillary Clinton to win the election. I said, that's nonsense, because if you look at it, the Donald Trump shit show has gotten more ratings than anything. It's roped people in constantly. It's almost like the old Howard Stern syndrome. People who loved him would listen to him for 2.5 hours on the premise of, I want to hear what he says next. People who hated him listened for 3.5 hours saying, I want to hear what he says next. And that's how it is with Trump. So no, the press wanted Trump because this is ratings.
Right.
This is ratings for every outlet there is. The problem is nobody's reporting, as you've said, from the day this all began, nobody's reporting on the facts. And the facts are, how come no one's been investigating in more depth how, you know, North Korea could have a Russian-made ICBM that's from, what, 30, 40 years ago?
Right.
You know, how powerful could that ICBM be at this stage? And by the way, nobody made anything of this, which I think is a very alarming bit of news that should have been heard, excuse me, nationally. But in Hawaii, they were having nuclear missile alerts.
Yep.
Again. And practice drills.
Right, for the first time since the Reagan administration. They set off those alarms, and, I mean, aside from weather emergencies, those things haven't been heard from since then. And all of a sudden, you've got a very worried populace in our 50th state. Does Donald Trump know, by the way, that Hawaii is, in fact, a state? Do we know this?
If I could interject for a second, I didn't plan on appearing on today's show, but, you know, when I was president, I signed a law banning Russia. I knew how to keep them in their place. I don't think Donnie Boy knows exactly what he's doing. Oh, hang on. I got to go answer the cake again.
So, it's all crazy and insane, but it seems to be that way every week. So not really a whole lot of brand new news there. But there are some things going on outside of that world, and I want to get into a longer discussion with you about this, but there's an album you wanted to take apart that's celebrating its 25th anniversary. I believe it's this week was the anniversary of the release. Where are we going in the music world this time?
Automatic for the People by R.E.M.
Yeah.
25th anniversary. There is now a 25th anniversary edition complete with, I believe it's 20 never-before-heard demos. And there was a Dolby mix done of it as well. So, of course, there's different permutations of the packaging and so on and so forth. And as someone who, for lack of a better phrase, got into REM from the very beginning, when I first, as we all know, as I'd read the article, from the time that Chronic Town came out, this was the album that I will go on a limb here and say maybe REM's legacy album. This was probably REM's biggest, most successful album. And this was the album that completely put me off of them once and for all.
Yeah.
They put out things afterwards that I liked, a few things that I heard here and there, but they lost me with this one. But let's start with the whole quick background behind it. And I'm sure I'm going to catch a lot of flack because this is the almost religious slash sanctified album for most REM fans, which if you were a fan of the band from the time that they first came along, I can't see how you'd want to keep going on this ride with them at this point. All I just remember is I got the album home with a great deal of anticipation, as I always did with a new REM album.
Mm-hmm.
And from Document onward, I started having this up and down ride. It's kind of like, you know, ebbs and flows of this is actually good. I was very surprised at how much I liked, by and large, Out of Time, which at that point was just an enormous success, and I'm probably understating it because that's the album that gave us Losing My Religion, which is easily, I would say, their legacy track. That's the song the entire world and then some knows. But it had some real clunkers on that album. However, the songs that I really liked are actually songs that are still with me as part of, let's say, for argument's sake, my REM top 10. You know, there are at least, there's one definite, but there are two that I just think are so great and so important to the overall REM canon that that album will get a pass from me. And it doesn't matter how successful it was, by and large, it had its great moments. When I first heard Drive, which was the opening track and first single off Automatic for the People, all I could think was, Jesus Christ, I've heard this before, and this is not interesting anymore.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's the same D minor arpeggio Peter Buck guitar bullshit. No offense meant to Peter Buck. I think the world of him, and I have the utmost respect for him. But at that point, we're talking about what I heard in 1992. And just being absolutely bored senseless throughout the rest of the album. If I ever have to hear Everybody Hurts, I don't need to worry about committing suicide because I am going to hurt them.
Yeah.
Can't stand that fucking song. Talk about light and pandering and ugh. Don't throw your hand. No, don't make me throw up my lunch.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on that one. I don't know if I'm as much against this album in its entirety as you are. I don't like it. And in fact, the only tracks on it that I would say that I actively enjoy are the obvious ones. I like Man on the Moon. And really, that's it. That's the only one. I was gonna say, you know, even
I'll give you that one because I actually do kind of like that one also.
Yeah,
that's one of the few that I can actually like. I also kind of like Monty Got a Raw Deal. It's clumsy, yeah,
right?
But I like it. I think the way the song itself sounds. The fact that Pete Buck is not playing a mandolin but a bouzouki, I think that's kind of cool and different. The song that I think I like the most on this album is Fuck Me Kitten. It's known as Star Me Kitten, but since we're not censored, we don't have to say star.
Right.
Uh-huh. It's Fuck Me Kitten, and you know, even then I heard what they were attempting to do, and that's to get the feel of 10cc's I'm Not in Love.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's a great song. It's a great lyric. It's not a predictable REM track. Then you get the rest of these weenie roast kinds of songs, like, you know, Try Not to Breathe and, oh, The Sidewinder Sleeps Tonight.
Yep.
Oh, I hate when they got cutesy.
Right.
That was something that REM did so badly, you know. It was like they stopped being REM and became too much of U2 at that point, and that really found me so put off. And I just,
right.
This was the one where I finally said, I give up. And I walked away from them, you know. I bought Monster when it came out 2 years later, and I liked a lot of it, but there are a couple of factors. One, I hated the fact that Pete Buck had a new toy, so he was going to use it on every track. Much the way he overused the mandolin, this time he started to overuse his reverb.
Ah, right.
You know? And the ultra fuzzy heavy sound of the guitar on each track, because basically every track sounded alike. Also, this album started, Monster wound up starting the whole thing where I would play, okay, what did they rewrite from the last album? I mean, I did start that around Green because Turn You Inside Out was a rewrite of Finest Work song. And, you know, you go from each album onward. Like, Strange Currencies is a guitar, is an electric rewrite of Everybody Hurts.
Yep.
And so on from each album onward. And, you know, it just really, really started to put a crimp, and that's putting it nicely, in my whole overview of REM, which was a band that I, you know, I held very near and dear because it had been from the beginning, and because, as I've said before, you know, they were really important to me since they were the band that replaced the Jam in my scope, you know, because they were the way forward. You know, the Jam had come to a stop, and they were British, and they were much older than we were. REM were American. They were younger. They were themselves. They didn't, you know, they didn't have a particular look the way the Jam had, the whole mod thing. You know, these were just four normal guys, no different than us. And, you know, and just the sound and the excitement and the energy that, that came out of Chronic Town all the way through the Fables of the Reconstruction. That was something that I loved and will never be replaced. That can never be changed or altered by history or the shitty records that they put out subsequently.
Right.
But Automatic for the People, I don't understand. I mean, maybe I do now in a little bit more hindsight. It was after we had just gone through the whole Bush 41 era. But then you had the immediate panderings of Clinton and Gore, and that turned into horseshit too. I just want to say one thing about that. as your president, when REM were in, you know, big on the charts, when I was in the White House and running the Oral Office, all I want to say about that is go, baby.
But the thing is, you know, about the cutesy thing, in my mind, and I agree with you in full, I mean, stuff like Shiny Happy People and The Sidewinder Sleeps Tonight and all of that crap, I think what happened was they did it once to try to be, well, and trying to be ironic again is a bit of a problem, but they were going after that, you know, we have all of these deep lyrics and all of this literary references and stuff written in French and all of that. Let's do something goofy. And they released Stand as a single. And I was fine with that. And okay, yeah, I get it. And it's kind of funny and it's a decent, you know, nothing riff and that's fine. And then Michael Stipe decided, okay, I'm going to make kind of a career of that. You talked about the rewrites and the fact that they rewrote songs for the next album always. Well, what are all of those songs, if not outgrowths of Stand?
You're 150,000% correct. And it goes back to A, I think once Stipe's vocals came more to the front and he had to enunciate the fucking lyrics.
Right.
Because, let's face it, we just loved making up the shit as we went along because we didn't know what the hell he was saying. With the exception of House in Order, do we really know what the hell he's saying in Wolves Lower?
No.
The fact that he actually said the lyrics clearly enough in the chorus of Talk About the Passion that, oh, wait a minute, it's a good thing I minored in French. I understand what the hell he's saying. I was probably the only one.
Yeah.
Because the rest was all, nah, okay. Having said that, you know, you could smell the atrocity of cutesiness beginning around Document.
Yeah.
You could smell it. It was starting to happen because they took a song like Strange by Wire and made it a little too cutesy.
Mm-hmm. You
know? But you can overlook it because it was just a cover. However, It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine. That was... Between that and just a shitty song like the one I love.
But, yeah.
And we all know I can't stand Document, and I never have, and there's nothing that will ever make me like that album. And I'm not counting the songs on there that I think that are okay, of which there are very few. The point is, that was really the focal point of when they started to go awry. You get to Green, and yeah, you got a real piece of shit like Stand. Pop song 89, the overblown, heavy-handed, pretentious and preciousness and God knows early PC-isms of World Leader Pretend, and then turning into fucking U2 on Orange Crush.
Uh-huh.
Forget it. At that moment, I was starting to think you're dead to me, you know? I'm starting to hate you guys. But then there was a weird kind of redemption in the nature of Out of Time, even though I hate Radio Song, and I want to beat all of them with a lead pipe for that, I liked Losing My Religion on the first couple of listens.
Right.
You know, it's a different and very interestingly odd song. Near Wild Heaven, I liked. The only thing I liked about Shiny Happy People is Kate Pearson's voice.
Right.
And I'll get to that song in a moment because you brought up such a good point about it. The two songs, though, that are everlasting for me, however, from that album, without a doubt, are Texarkana, which is, I think, Mike Mills' shining moment of shining moments, of many. And one of my absolute favorites that to this day, I still get chills whenever I hear it, is Me and Honey.
Yeah.
Which is one of the most oft-forgotten songs, and one of the most propulsive things that band ever did. But you brought up the really good point that, okay, they were trying to be ironic. And, you know, Mike Mills himself talked about Shiny Happy People and how, you know, we consciously wrote goofy songs because we didn't want to be seen as this kind of heavy-handed band. And, you know, Pete Buck making fun of them, saying, you know, like, oh, we're a mystic art band, and, you know, we basically pray for another album to be dropped in our laps, you know. Those two at least knew that this was all bullshit, and I give them full credit. But it's like Mike Mills said, we knew we were going into a dangerous area because people, for whatever reason, love that title, you know, and it's pithy, and it's contemporary, and it's postmodernist, and it's bullshit is what it is. Shiny Happy People is a stupid, irritating song.
Yeah.
But it's one that's kind of, in the grand scheme of that album, which is, it's a little bit, in a lot of ways, I think Out of Time is closest to Fables of the Reconstruction because it's very constrictive. It's a darker album than you would think. You know, Shiny Happy People is the one absolute weirdness because even as jovial and happy-go-lucky sounding as the riff to Me and Honey is, listen to the lyrics. It's about the male point of view when he finds out his partner is pregnant.
Right.
That's not a funny or happy-go-lucky feeling when she's basically telling him, I'm making the decisions here and you're left out in the cold. You know? You get to Automatic for the People. We all know Drive is very simply Rock On by David Essex, which was so much better.
Right.
And that's offensive to me because nobody called them out to the carpet for it. You know, why weren't they sued for outright plagiarism? You've sung it. You've sung one, you know, interpolated over the other.
Right.
As I have, you know, and it's offensive, you know?
Yep.
Sidewinder Sleeps Tonight, man, it's just a collective slap to all four of them for that, you know? If I have to hear about Nescafe on Ice and Dr. Seuss, I'm going to hurt you. I'm going to find you, and I'm going to hurt you.
The only good thing about that song now is listening to it and thinking, wow, that song came out at a time when if you called somebody and they weren't home, the phone just kept ringing. You know? That's it. That's the only thing, because it's a reminder that it was a different time before cell phones and when voicemail wasn't ubiquitous.
Which is interesting, because on the next album, the song Star 69 comes along, yep. And it's already on that the crossover has happened.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Because we're heading into this next era. You know, Man on the Moon I like because I was an enormous fan of Andy Kaufman.
Yep.
And I always thought he was a genius. I thought he was a genius with the whole, the wrestling thing made me love him even more, especially because he gave a greater light to one of my all-time heroes. And I've said it on this show. I've said it to you in private. And I'll say it again. When I grow up, I'm going to be Fred Blassie because Fred Blassie was the king of men. He was the Hollywood fashion plate. Classy Freddie Blassie was it. Pencil neck geeks. But Stipe gave, I would like to think that he gave Andy Kaufman a whole new audience because people are so willing to take whatever you feed them, of course. People, I hope, looked up Andy Kaufman and discovered that he was truly a visionary and a genius because he wasn't a comedian. He wasn't a comic. He was a performance artist when performance art could be something like that because I hear the words performance art and I think two words, no talent. Sorry, three words, no discernible talent.
Right, right. And with Andy, it was different. And by the way, on the Andy Kaufman front, there is something interesting that dropped this week. There's a movie called Jim and Andy that's a documentary of Jim Carrey's portrayal of Andy Kaufman in Man on the Moon because everybody knows, I think by now, who is interested at all in that legacy, that when Jim Carrey was filming that movie, was totally method in the way that he did things and took on the character of Andy Kaufman to the point of annoying all of the people on the set and making them all call him Andy, and he refused to, you know, answer to anything else. And that's fine. But the good news about what he did is that he had a film crew follow him the entire time that he was making that movie. So now there's a document of him going method on Andy Kaufman behind the scenes. I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard that it's amazing.
The thing that I hate about that movie, apart from Courtney Love,
yeah,
and Jim Carrey, because I can't stand him as
same here.
Is the fact that, even though I love, what's his name?
Paul Giamatti.
Thank you. I think he's amazing in everything he does.
Yep.
I hated it because I've seen and I loved Andy Kaufman on From Hollywood. And all this was taken almost verbatim from that, with some dialogue splashed in here and there. And I hated the fact that Danny DeVito was playing, what's his name? George, what was the name of the manager?
Yeah,
George.
I can't remember, but yeah, right. And not playing Danny DeVito.
Right. I mean, you know, when they did the taxi scene, which I thought was really kind of stupid of them because you could see they all visibly looked older, except for Christopher Lloyd, who's always looked the same age.
Yeah.
Okay, boss. You know, it was just such a poorly written script is what it was.
Yeah.
That's what I hated about it. Period. The thing with Andy Kaufman is he was brilliant, and there's so much, because you and I grew up in that period when we saw him do this stuff as it happened on TV. Like seeing him, and I was all of what, 8 or 9 on Saturday Night Live.
Right.
And of course, I saw it. Andy's Funhouse, when it was broadcast, I think it was at 10 o'clock on either a Friday or Saturday on ABC, and thinking it was brilliant. I got it. But then again, I was a kid. That's the whole point. It was supposed to be for kids. But all these fucking uber critics, all these pseudo-intellectuals in the know, wanted, you know, dissect things to the nth degree, and they didn't get it. It was, you know, he wanted to host a kids show, and that was his idea of it. And I think it was brilliant because I got it, you know? It was great. But then the Fridays shit started happening, and that was not funny. It was lame. As it was irritating. And I got that too. And you know, my parents were watching Fridays with me when he came back and he did the apology a week later. And most people, they didn't even bring this up in the movie, which is such an important thing because he was keeping it going. He gets into the fight on stage. A week later, he comes back out and says, I've converted to born-again Christianity. He brings this Jesus freak girl out, and he says that they're getting married, and they sing this Jesus song and all this kind of shit. And my parents are like, what the hell is wrong with him? I was like, it's obvious.
It's shtick. Yeah, right.
You two are older than me, and you should know. You know, I was, what, 16 when that was on? I said, you should know this. He's carrying it on. Yep. Are you kidding? This didn't happen in the span of a week.
Right. Yep. Yeah, and he's poking a stick at everybody who was going after him, which is what you do. I mean, it was so obvious, and yet that's why it was brilliant, is because it served its purpose, and it pissed them off even further.
Right. But at the same time, now we're, you know, getting back to, which is like usual, we get into these one great topic, and all of a sudden we're getting away from the focus at hand. You know, that's the one thing I appreciate. I mean, it's a catchy song, but Man in the Moon, I think, helped propel Andy Kaufman to what I would hope, keyword is hope, into a much bigger and better light, so that people would actually take the time to seek out his work and understand him.
Yeah.
Because he was just that funny and forward-thinking and brilliant. But the rest of that album, you know, there was an interview this week with, of all people, Dan Rather, who is probably the only one left worth watching or listening to as far as news giants go.
Right.
And he's on this channel called Axis, AXS, and he has a show called The Big Interview, and he interviewed Mike Mills and Michael Stipe, I guess it was all of 2 weeks ago or a week ago, and it was shown this past Tuesday, and they're talking about the album, and you know, they're rhapsodizing about Find the River, and, you know, what's the other really slow, Night Swimming, And I'm thinking, those are the two that put me into a quick coma. You know, those are the songs that are just so lifeless and humdrum because, frankly, when REM got slow, they got way too slow.
Yep.
And they didn't hold my interest anymore. You know, for me, slow REM was maybe something like Talk About the Passion. You know, when you get to some of the later albums, like Life Search Pageant, Flowers of Guatemala get completely glossed over by me because it's too slow.
Yeah.
I want to hear the slow stuff. You know, I really don't. I never listen to the slow things like Low or Country Feedback off of Out of Time, you know. As you know, even though you love the songs, and I hold no, you know, I always skip over Wendell G. And Old Man Kinsey, you know, or Auctioneer just sucks. That's a lousy song.
Yeah, that is a terrible song.
Good Advice is I Can Take or Leave, but of course, I'll listen to it more often than not because I ripped it off and wrote Train of Thought, which is obviously an infinitely better and much more powerful and greater song than that could have ever hoped to be, but that's another story.
Yeah.
But REM just became slow and plodding on this album, and it took away from me the last vestiges I had of an absolute love for that band. That and the fact that it seemed everybody and his mother, who previously had said, oh, REM, I can't stand them. You know, his voice is too ethereal and too disconnected, and now they all of a sudden they all just loved REM.
Yeah, you know, the bandwagon effect was a little hard to take, sure.
Ironically, of course, the song Bandwagon looms large in my legend. But,
right.
And that's exactly what it is. And it just, you know, I was like, you know what? As I say unto you too, so do I say unto REM, fuck all of you.
Well, yeah, you know? And there's more than just that, because while you were talking about Dan Rather, it started to occur to me. There was a time when we could depend on guys like David Letterman, oddly enough. I mean, DJs had already all but gone. And I remember, by the way, hearing about Andy Kaufman's death, oddly enough, from a DJ. And it's one of those moments where I remember exactly where I was and what I was doing. I was riding in a car with my mom going to the orthodontist's office. And the news came over that Andy Kaufman had died. And even at that point, that DJ in Tampa said, well, but given all the stunts he's pulled in the past, how can we really be sure? You know, so it was one of those strange moments. And it was, you know, when he actually had died, even then there were people questioning it, which was great. But the idea of having those coolest kids in the room, you know, the radio jocks who would bring us new shit and tell us what was good. I think the last time I ever heard a song broken that I thought was really interesting, it was Dada's Disneyland.
I just crashed my car again. Now I'm going to Disneyland. I just robbed a grocery store. I'm going to Disneyland. Just flipped off President George. I'm going to Disneyland. I'm going to Disneyland.
The jock talked up the song before he played it and said, you know, this is something we haven't heard in a while. This is a really interesting take on things, and it's a much darker song than it sounds like, and it's called Disneyland, and that's kind of funny, and then played the song. And I was really into it. So after that happened, we had to depend on guys like, well, David Letterman, for example, brought us Toad the Wet Sprocket. He was the one who kind of broke them and said, hey, I really like these guys. Check them out. Here's Glenn Phillips and Toad the Wet Sprocket. And bands like REM and all of them, there was at least a venue there. And now, as much as I like Colbert and as much as I could take or leave Jimmy Fallon or any of them, really, they're not doing that anymore. There's nothing interesting coming out of that world where the guys who are your age and my age and maybe even a little bit older like Colbert, they just don't do it. It's all, you know, the conglomerated ratings game again.
A couple of things. One, like you, I remember exactly when and where, because we would, Mark, who was the bass player at the time of 2 Minutes Late, and I were walking with a boombox back from Wave Street, which is not too far from where I currently live. But we were walking back from Wave Street going to the train station. Wave Street was a club on Staten Island, and we had just dropped off a cassette because we were trying to book gigs.
Yeah.
Right? when we heard on the radio that Andy Kaufman had died. So I remember that as clearly as anything. Two, it was David Letterman who put R.E.M. on television for the very first time in October 1983.
I thought so, yeah.
Radio Free Europe, and then the as yet untitled song, which they had just finished and played. And the only thing that anybody knew was that the song had a refrain going, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry," which of course we all know is Southern Central Rain,
right.
"I'm sorry." Later on, that 6 months later, in March 1984, when it came out on a single, March 31st to be exact. Three, we're actually older than Colbert. And by the way, Colbert's favorite band, we're actually older than him. I think he's a couple of years younger than both you and I.
Huh.
Or at least, he's certainly younger than me. Sure. But you're younger than me.
Now I'm going to have to look it up and find out. He is 53, yeah, so he's about 5 years older.
He's older than me. He's older than me by a couple of months, I guess. I thought I was older than him. R.E.M. was his favorite band. And he had them on constantly. And if you remember correctly, he had on Skype on the final shows when he was doing the sale.
Right.
You know, selling everything off like everything must go.
And had him playing that sort of Elf on the Shelf thing. Yeah, I do.
Well, selling for a quarter, which is still 12.5 cents way too much. You know, when you watch a show like Jimmy Fallon, I remember when the Reconstituted Replacements were on, and Fallon introduced them in a way that had absolutely nothing about it.
There's no knowledge.
No enthusiasm. There was it was almost like a perfunctory reading of the cue cards. And now this band, who has been so critically lauded, is back, and they are the Replacements. Wow. That couldn't have been more uninspiring than anything. If I'm not mistaken, the song that they played was Alex Chilton. So, you know, what can you say except, ha ha!
Right.
Nevertheless, hell, as much as I can't stand him, Jaw Leno had Big Star. He was the only one that had Big Star when they came back, you know?
Right.
And this was 1992, 1993 when it happened?
Yeah, and that's another one of those cases where you know it meant something to him. Granted, if you're a TV show host like that, there are going to be things on you don't care about or don't know about or both. But you know when it's different because they make note of it. And they say, listen, I found these guys. Somebody turned me on to them. I love them. We invited them to be on the show. That's the kind of push that nobody gets anymore because it's... I think it's almost impossible for even them to find new things.
Well, you know what? Letterman was a guy who was very attuned to all of this stuff because he seemed to have very hip musical tastes. It wasn't he certainly didn't pander to the audience. I don't feel. I always thought Letterman was one of the guys that, you know, he didn't pull any punches. Yeah, when he moved over to CBS, he was a lot older. I mean, he'd been doing the show for 10 years at that point on NBC. He was in an earlier time slot. It was a different audience. You have to temper yourself, but you're also older and you're not as much of an abrasive being. I would tend to think more often than not.
Right.
And, you know, he still had R.E.M. on occasionally, but at that point they were old guard, you know? I mean, don't forget, the very last band to ever appear on Letterman was, quote, my favorite band and the band that got me through my heart surgery, the Foo Fighters.
Yep.
So, obviously, he's got, you know, he has a sense of taste and being attuned to it all. But, you know, of course, with Dan Rather being the one interviewing them, there is, of course, the fact that R.E.M. had done What's the Frequency, Kenneth? And there is a clip of Dan Rather actually singing it, attempting to sing it with them during the sound check during the 1995 tour, which is, it's painful, but it's funny.
Yeah.
Because, obviously, he's got both no voice and no sense of timing. Unless, you know, when you're nervous, are you going to sing on cue with a big rock band? I don't think so, especially when it's a sound check. Even though it's just sound check. But Madison Square Garden, come on. Even I'd be overwhelmed, probably.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, Dan Rather is like the last of the – it's the threading of the generations. Dan Rather interviewing a now 57-year-old Michael Stipe and 59-year-old Mike Mills. Well, 52-year-old me is watching this, yeah. And Dan Rather's not even on CBS. I mean, that's, you know, But the thing is that 25 years have passed, dare I say, in the blink of an eye. And I went back and I re-listened to Automatic for the People in its entirety this week, you know, end to end. Frankly, I don't need to get into the demos because at this stage, I don't care about extra items that come along. If you put out a box set of unreleased things, I mean, full unreleased songs that just didn't make the grade, that's one thing. Demos, I don't give a shit about. I lost an interest when I heard 47,000 permutations of Strawberry Fields Forever.
Right.
I just don't need demos. I listened to the album in full again. And, you know, as I am want to do at this age, at this stage, and as part of the fact that I do this, you know, on a regular basis as a writer for Pop Goes, I tried to find something good or redeeming or something I hadn't found before within the context of trying to listen to this with fresh ears. It had been, I don't know how long since I actually listened to it from start to finish, and all I could come up with was, I think the only time I'd ever listened to it from start to finish was the day I bought it and put it away and never listened to it again. That's number one. Number two, I still find myself going over the same stumbling blocks. I tried to put myself in I'm hearing this for the first time, and I don't know much about REM, which is a very difficult thing to do. I just don't find anything that moves me except for Fuck Me Kitten. I still really think is a very powerful and very emotionally moving song. Because when you read the lyrics, it's about as close as a, quote, normal conversational lyric to a lover that you could possibly have.
Right.
You know? It's accusatory because it says, I'm in your possession, so fuck me, kitten. It's like, okay, I'm weak-willed, but here, do with me what you want. And that's powerful, and that's moving. But it's also a sense of, you know, I've got keys, I have three, but you can't have one. That's kind of retaliatory. And again, when you're in a long-term relationship with somebody, you're going to have these kinds of spates and back and forths and lulls where things aren't so great. And then, now maybe I'm thinking twice about us. And if we're living together, well, shit, I may want you out of here. Or I may go, but I'm not going to tell you because we're both playing a game. Ah.
Right.
Oh, but wait, you look good naked. You know, I mean, that's real. I mean, I'm not being facetious when I say it. It's all part and parcel of the whole mindset that one has / gets into when they're in a relationship. So it's all psychological warfare. Again, Man on the Moon, that's catchy. The rest, I've got nothing. I get nothing from that album that emotionally moves me or stimulates me. I even listened all the way through to Everybody Hurts, and I still just don't like that song. There's just something about it I have never liked and will never have a taste for it.
No.
And again, I bought it the day it came out, so I hadn't heard it or had any preordained notions or disposition towards whether or not I was going to be biased in a positive or negative way regardless, drive aside. And I just glossed over it because it was too damn long. You know? The consensus is Automatic for the People is still, it's probably tied neck and neck with Reveal as the two albums that I really can't listen to the whole thing all the way through. And Up, those are the three. They're pretty much unlistenable. Everyone hates Around the Sun. I actually like that album a great deal and can listen to it all the way through. I usually tend to skip a couple of songs because they never seem to end. But two or three songs versus most of the album, there's a difference there.
Yeah, oh, no doubt. And that brings us into the In Our Head segment in an interesting fashion, because I wanted to go off into sort of a different direction with it this week, because we've talked a lot about songs, we've talked a lot about particular bands for one reason or another, or albums, but you mentioned that REM at one point had gone right down the U2 line. And oddly enough, as we were talking about Saturday Night Live, U2 was the featured musical act on SNL this week. So it started me to thinking while I was watching them, and it was fine. I mean, the performance was fine, and sure, it's U2, and they're going to say something pretentious to the audience, and they did, and that's fine, because it's expected. But You know, I've wondered before if they are going to be rock and roll's last great act, because they're the only ones that still fill arenas, and I hate the idea, not so much because I hate U2 or anything like that, it's just that I hate the idea that that era is come to a close and will never return, that there will never be an act that will tour around and fill up stadiums that we haven't heard of yet as of 2017, that there's an arena rock act out there and we just don't know them yet. And I don't know if you give that any hope at all, or if it's just something that we have to remember from when we were younger.
I hold little to no hope, frankly. I'm sorry to say, because the only word that comes to my mind repeatedly, it's almost like a mantra when it comes to current music, musical trends, bands, whatever you want to call it, is less than mediocre.
Yeah, disposable.
Forgettable. There's no attachment to it. And I don't think it has to do with age. And I think you and I have had this conversation. It may have been on air, it may have been off air, but you know, there's certainly no attachment whatsoever to what's come along in these last couple of years. And you and I started to go down the route of talking about, you know, these new bands that seem to fill out places like Madison Square Garden with ease one day, but maybe a year or two later can't really sell a ticket because audiences are fickle as it is right now. Nobody's got really much of an attention span, and they don't buy albums and hold them near and dear to themselves as we did.
Right.
So our generation is the last one. U2 is definitely, I think you're right. Sad to say that they are the last great arena rock act, which is interesting because Rolling Stones aside, or Paul McCartney aside, they're from another generation.
Yeah, right. And yeah,
that we're talking about that punk new wave era, even though U2 came along far after the wave of new wave had started to sort of smooth out before it hit the beach, and U2 had that palatable sound of their own, you know. A band like Radiohead is not even worth the time talking about. They're not something that I would even care to waste our time with. And everything that follows in their wake, like Coldplay and all those shitty bands. But there are those obnoxious bands like you brought up Mumford & Sons. And there's a band called The Hold Steady that people seem to talk about that I know nothing about and don't really care to. And then what was the group that, again, I forgot their name, but I said to you the other day, the one with the dress code.
Oh, it wasn't Radiohead. Who was it?
Arcade Fire.
That's right, Arcade Fire, yep.
Now, who cares? And fuck you.
Right.
That's it. That's all I have to say about them. There are no bands out there that really... I mean, Green Day? Green Day is fourth-rate, reconstituted and regurgitated stiff little fingers with some Clash and Ramones undertones for good measure.
Right.
Anything and everything that Green Day did, you just listen to Dookie, and you know that that's fucking rewrites of Stiff Little Fingers and Flammable Material.
Yeah, yeah, and you're the same.
Any day of the week.
Right, and it's not that there aren't people out there doing interesting things. There are, and we've profiled a bunch of them here, and we'll continue to do that into the future, but the hope that they will, that the machine that's responsible for letting us have these things grow, is ever going to be interested in them, that's what's missing. And it just isn't. I mean, the music industry, such as it is only interested in the next 15 minutes, like every other industry is. And so what do they care if a band's around 10 years from now? They don't. There's no reason to invest in them.
Well, it's no longer a machine. At one time, it was like a factory. You know, you had a whole bunch of bands go in, come out, you know, packaged for instant stardom. Nowadays, it's like a little meth lab. You know, it's like a trailer in the middle of the desert.
Yep.
You know, you can package for enough for a smattering of the population, and that's it. And U2, I've always had this kind of like-dislike relationship. I've never loved them.
Yeah.
The things I really liked were Gloria, and I liked the October album a lot, and the single right after that, A Celebration. And oddly enough, I didn't like anything by them until they kind of struck me with, hey, you know, they're doing something new and different with Achtung Baby. As obnoxious as that was, you got, see, this is where it gets interesting, because with that, you understand where they were going. after all the accolades and being on the cover of Time magazine and them being the absolute arbiters of what became PC and the first of the virtue signalers as far as rock bands go.
Right.
You know, they even looked at themselves and said, no, we're a fucking rock band, you know.
Yeah, right. Let's not take this too seriously.
Right. I mean, we're just, at the end of the day, we're not greatly educated musicians. And so they played up the whole rock myth. And I applaud them for that. And plus, Octoon Baby had some really good songs on it. And then I just kind of got tired of them again because it was just, you know, nothing disposable music that they put out until, is it called All That You Can't Leave Behind, the one that has Beautiful Day on
yep.
it?
Yeah.
That was a really good song, period. It's a really good song, and it was a good album.
Right.
So that made me kind of go, okay, you know what, this is good. And also, when they came back with that record, they stripped everything away. There were no characters, there were no costumes, there was no stage show. It was just them up there, meat and potatoes. And I really liked and appreciated that. They went back to that kind of thing. Now, you two aside, their only other, I don't want to call it their competition, but their only other compatriots on the same wave was, of course, R.E.M. And R.E.M. didn't do anything original. What they did was they took the cue from U2, because they in turn became what U2 had become with the, you know, sensitive ponytail guys and, you know, tofu-eating motherfuckers and twisted, ham-handed, slogan-earing bullshit that panders to the audience of eager and willing, you know, anti-establishment types. And they put out an album like Monster, which is just, you know, it's a dick record. It's cock rock. But unlike the gutsy and adventurous way that U2 put out Achtung Baby, which they tempered very well with the songs in the album, R.E.M. got it all wrong. You know, they completely bungled that concept up on Monster because every song sounds identical. And they're all songs about your dick.
Yeah. Right.
You know, and that's not funny or cute or tee-hee-hee, especially when now you're in your 30s. Now, that's the kind of stupid shit you do when you're a teenage band.
Yeah, and if there's any postscript that I can put on this that's going to make it make some sense, it's that, or at least take away some of the melancholy from it, because we're basically talking about the end of an era, is that it's all the more important to go out and see live music. Go to a bar. Go to a bar and see a band you've never heard of before, because you never know. And I've had this happen where I've been surprised at least 4 or 5 times with bands that I saw in bars that I became an instant fan of and have followed ever since. And it doesn't matter anymore that they don't get played on the radio or that you're the only one in the room who has ever heard of them, because if you can find that spark of a thing that made us follow bands around the country in the first place, then that's really the only thing that makes any difference, is that it means that much to you. But you're never going to find them depending on somebody else to do the work. You've got to go out and you've got to watch somebody do their thing and decide if they're worth following it at all after that.
Well, at the same time, you know, and you bring up such a good point, because I haven't had that happen where I've gone to just a club or anything, because nowadays clubs only seem to book cover bands.
Yep.
That's really, you know, the upshot of the club scenes. But certainly when I saw the Dream Syndicate and their opening band was Easy TV. Dust in the sky.
Dust in the sky.
That was one of those eureka moments,
right,
where you're standing there, and of course, and I'll say it again, I have seen the future of power pop, and it is them. You know, it was such a wonderful, that was that kind of wonderful feeling that I'm sure that John Landau had when he met and saw Bruce Springsteen for the first time, or McLaren may have had when he discovered the Sex Pistols, if he really did discover the Sex Pistols.
Yeah.
You know, or Chris Parry had when Shane McGowan told him, go see the Jam. You know, it's that kind of thing that happened. Or even though it's not in the same musical genre, when I went to see Booker T perform and Elle Winston came out and opened up, and I was just floored by her voice and her presentation and the songs and everything. And I think she's just magnificent. And granted, this is just her first album, but I hope to God word starts to spread more, because she's one of those artists you want to see grow and explode and expand. And but people also need to be informed. They need to, and I'm not plugging it for the sake of plugging it. People need to go to something like Pop Dose.
Yes.
It's all well and good to go to something like Pop Matters or Pitchfork, or, but they're more in step with name brands already.
Mm-hmm.
Pop Dose isn't. Pop Dose, we tend to pluck, not by choice, but really by necessity, the obscure, because we're the only place that gives an airing to these different musicians and performers. And I got to tell you something. I find myself more often than not rather irritated when I get pitches from publicists, not because of the shitty way that they all write or approach you, but because they started off with that kind of ass-kissing bullshit of, you know, well, I know you give, you know, a lot of time to, you know, female. No, don't do that. Don't start playing the gender card or the genre card. No, no, no.
Right.
If you read the fucking thing, you know that none of us are locked into any one thing. Yeah, we all have the bads that we like. Yeah, I'm the Big Star fan, you know? But I'm just as much a fan of the Buzzcocks.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I'll fucking write a piece about Gary Lewis and the Playboys. You know, I don't care. It's music I like. You know, if I hear it and I like it. And that's why so many undiscovered bands get, you know, noticed by Pop Dose and get airtime and get featured, because these are things you should hear. Whether it's Little Chief or Aaron Lee Tazjan or Sophia Talvik, or, you know, or I don't care who, actually. Yeah. Or Fragile Tomorrow.
I was just about to say, yeah.
Sorry, there was some little news out of that camp. Dominic Kelly is no longer the drummer.
Oh, really?
Dominic has decided he's going to play keyboards now instead.
Huh.
So they've got a drummer. So now they're a five-piece.
Interesting. All right, good. I'm looking forward to seeing what the next thing out of them is then.
But just to sum up what we were saying, you know, when you do have some outlets, and if you can't get to a show, it behooves you to read something like Pop Dose. And it's not a plug. It's just that we're a necessary thing.
Yeah.
And at this stage of the game, it's almost a very sad statement that we're one of the last ones that do what we do the way we do it.
Right, and professionally, with new and original content. And again, it's starting to sound like a commercial, but it's just true. So go kick around. We tell you this every week. Go kick around elsewhere on the site. Read some things and click on the links and listen to new music and find maybe some music that came out in 1962 that you've never heard before, because you'll find a lot of that elsewhere on the site as well.
Yeah, try reading Kent Chain's Soul Serenade.
Please, because, yeah, it's one of the better columns. But they're all great, so check them out. And Rob Ross, I think that's going to about wrap it up for you and me, but always, as always, great stuff, and I look forward to talking to you again next week.
All right, my brother, have a good one, be well, and I will talk to you soon.
You got it.